Carol Firstman is an essayist, memoirist, and journalist. Her writing has appeared in numerous magazines, newspapers, and literary journals, including the Colorado Review, the South Dakota Review, the Watershed Review, Lifestyle Magazine, and Valley Response, among many others. She received a Pushcart Prize special mention in her work and has twice been noted in Best American Essays. She currently teaches at the College of the Sequoias in Visalia, California, and Cal State University of Fresno. Carol Firstman, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
I am thrilled to finally talk to you about this wonderful debut memoir that I know you've been working. I just know because I've known you for quite some time now. We're both from the same city in Visalia,
yes.
In Visalia, California. I know that you have been working on your writing for a long time, and that this book comes out. It was just a thrill to me, and I was really excited to finally hold it in my hands and read it and read your testimony and your story. How does it feel for you to finally have, you know, your debut memoir out?
Well, it's really amazing. It's one of those things that you hope for and you work for so long. And, being my first book to come out, you always wonder, you know, will it ever see the light of day?
Yeah.
Will I find a publisher for it?
Right.
And now that it's here, it's just unbelievable. I'm on cloud nine. And I'm just thrilled. I feel like it's my baby. I mean, I feel...
Totally. That's exactly what it feels like, right?
Yeah. I'm very protective of my baby, and I want to help it grow and go into the world and be its own entity.
Yeah, and instead of like a 9-month incubation period, it's like a 10-year incubation period, you know?
Exactly,
like...
yes.
Yeah. First, let me ask you, how long have you been working on this book, on this project?
You know, that's interesting. I didn't realize I was working on this book for a long time. Parts of this book were actually written back in 2008 before I knew that they would become part of the manuscript.
Right.
So really, I mean, if you go back to 2008, you know, that's what, you know, like, I don't know, not quite 10 years, maybe 8 years or something. But I knew that it would become a book back in, I started writing seriously on it maybe about 6 years ago. And then I knew that pieces of it would actually become a book in 2013. So I drew from various pieces, and in 2013, actually within a 4-month period, I actually wrote the entire manuscript, incorporating in things I had been working on before.
That's kind of how working on books is for me also. I kind of, you know, I don't know really what the project is in the beginning. I just kind of piece together or intuit whatever the stories are. And then, you know, after a year or two, they start to kind of tell me what it wants to be, you know, and it sounds like that was a very similar process for you.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, because I would write independent pieces, mostly personal essays or travel articles, and they would be their own standalone piece. And it wasn't until quite a bit into the process I realized, oh, there's a certain thread running through a lot of these things I'm writing, and they actually kind of go together.
Right.
And that's what it's about.
Absolutely. And, you know, the book is called Origins of the Universe and What It All Means, and it is a memoir, and it's out with, how do you pronounce that? Is it Zonk? Zonk
it's
Books?
It's pronounced DeZank.
DeZank Books. DeZank.
Yes.
Okay. I've always wanted to know. That's one of those names I've always seen. Very reputable, you know, publication, obviously. And, but I never knew how to pronounce the name. You know, it's not as easy as some of the other names out there, but DeZank.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, good. Now I know.
Unusual. Yes. Zank Books. Yes.
Wonderful. And like, what was the period of time it took from the time you completed this manuscript to securing a publisher? Was it a long? Because I know sometimes there are these horror stories, right? And some take years, some never get published. But for you, but how long did it take?
Yeah. You know, it actually took, it took about, I want to say, quite a year and a half before I found the publisher. So the first summer after I finished it, I really focused on finding a literary agent.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked really hard for a whole summer on that. And I got a few nibbles, but no actual takers on the literary agent front.
Yeah.
And so then I shifted gears and I thought, okay, so now I'm going to work on submitting to some top shelf independent publishers that don't require an agent in order to submit.
Yeah.
And so I spent then the next summer really working on that, and I submitted to quite a few places, including it with that, I submitted to DeZank has an annual contest.
Right.
It's their nonfiction book prize. Mm-hmm. And I submitted to that, and I didn't hear anything back for a really long time.
Right.
And I kind of thought, well, I think that they've already probably selected the winner by now. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at their website, and I could see that they had released a book or two, and I thought, well, I don't want to bug them because you're not supposed to follow up or bug them, you know,
yeah.
after you submit, right?
Sure.
So,
yeah.
And I was kind of, I almost pulled it. So for
wow.
people that submit a lot, you're still familiar with the submittable website. And
yeah.
so it's this website, and it shows what's in progress and, you know, what's been declined and what's been accepted. And I was kind of obsessed with, it said in progress. And I thought, oh, well, it says in progress, but I think they've already chosen somebody.
Yeah.
So I think I'm going to withdraw it, just so that it's kind of a little bit OCD.
No, me too.
So that
yeah.
it goes to, it says the correct thing on there, so that it says withdrawn instead of in progress.
Right.
And I almost did that, and I got the call on a Friday, and I was planning on withdrawing it on Monday.
Wow.
And I got the call on Friday that I had won the contest, and with that comes an offer of publication. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow. In the
so
nick of time.
My advice to everybody is don't ever withdraw until you know for sure.
Yeah, you're
what's
right.
going on.
That's the lesson. Just leave it. Leave it be.
leave it be, yes.
That's like kind of a, I think it was Stephen King who, didn't he like dump his first novel, Carrie, into the trash can, and then his wife pulled it out one day, and then that's how it ended up making him. Yeah.
Yes, I think I read that story somewhere.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. I know. I think it was in his memoir on writing or something like that. Yeah, there was this sort of anecdote, which always kind of, it made me think twice, like, okay, from now on when I submit these things, like, I'm just going to leave them be, you know?
Yes, be patient.
Yeah, well, I had another friend, the author Daniel Granbois, who had a memoir also with a reputable publication, and they had already signed a contract and everything, and it was like, you know, 3 years later the book came out, and he was like, I don't even know if they're going to do it anymore, and it finally did. It was like, just leave it be.
Oh, yeah. You know, but, I had little fears like that, too. I guess it's the imposter syndrome.
Yes.
So
totally.
I won the contract, right? They sent me a contract. I'd signed the contract. But then there's like a long time between, so that was in like December of 2014.
Right.
Or no, you know, and like, it takes like over a year. It was like a year and a half before
right.
it actually came out in print. And the whole time, like, between signing the contract and until the actual back and forth editorial process began. So for months, I kept thinking, oh, surely they've made a mistake. They've gotten my manuscript mixed up with somebody else's. And any day now, they're going to call or email and tell me what a tragic mistake they've made. And they're not really going to publish it, you know?
Yeah, I know. I think if I were to write a memoir, that would be the title, The Imposter Syndrome, you know, or just The Imposter.
Yeah, the imposter, yeah.
You know, I want to get into the book itself, The Origins of the Universe, and what it all means. I mean, I really love this book, not just because you hail from my hometown also, but on a much, much larger scale. I expected a lot after I read the title. I expected a lot, Origins of the Universe and what it all means. I said, wow, she's going to, you know, there's a lot going on in this. I mean, it's the universe, come on, you know, in the origins. So, I mean, it does obviously, there's a theme that at work here, but it really does, you really do hone in very sharply on, you know, the, I guess I'll call them characters in the book, but the, you know, the, your family members. The book, for the most part, I guess maybe a kind of a general description of the narrative for our listeners would be that it's really a kind of an unabashed examination of your role as a daughter to an eccentric father.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least a father who's unavailable during your more formative years, you know. And I know that was partly because he had this undiagnosed Asperger syndrome. I mean, there were real moments in this book where I didn't just tear up. I mean, I bawled. I cried, you know, while reading it. The exchanges between daughter and yourself, your brother and your mother
mm-hmm.
when she was ill. I mean, just some really touching moments. How would you describe for our listeners just kind of a general narrative of the book?
Yeah, like you said, it's about my complicated relationship with my brilliant but very eccentric father. So he's retired now. He lives in Mexico now. He is still alive. But he used to be a biology professor who studied and collected spiders and scorpions. And so when I was a child, a young child, we would travel a lot, like to Mexico and Death Valley and the mountains of California, so that he could collect specimens for his research and use them as teaching tools for his students.
Right.
And so we would go hiking in the desert. I remember vividly being in the middle of the desert, and he would be crawling around on his hands and knees in the sand, and he would turn over a rock, and a scorpion would scuttle out, and he would catch it in the jar, right, and then fill the jar with alcohol or formaldehyde. And so during those young years when I grew up, there were just hundreds of those little jars lining the bookshelves in some of the rooms in our house. And so those were my early years. And so then as an adult, I think that instilled in me a love of a certain kind of travel, of going to far-off, rugged, isolated places that you normally wouldn't necessarily go to. And so my father and I were estranged for a number of years, from my mid-teens until about my mid-20s. We didn't talk. We didn't see each other. I knew we were estranged. He's so self-involved, I don't even think he knew we were estranged.
Right.
I don't think he knew. I don't think he cared.
Yeah. But he's like, you haven't changed a bit. Yeah.
But in my late 20s, we decided, let's get back together. Let's reconnect. Because I thought, oh, what a shame it would be for me to hold on to this resentment for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And if I never got to know this really interesting man that is my father. So back in 1994, we reconnected and we decided, hey, to get back together, let's go to Mexico for old time's sake. Let's go on a 2-week road trip, just the two of us, father and daughter, and we're going to go hiking through the remote desert and go on these adventures. And it seemed like a really good idea at the time.
And you had up until that point, you hadn't seen him for how many years now? I mean, you hadn't really been a part of his life.
Yeah, like 8 to 10 years.
Wow. So then you decide
really seen each other.
And you decide, let's just take a road trip together in Mexico and let's, you know.
let's reconnect. Yeah. What the heck?
Wow.
And it was an enlightening experience for both of us.
Sure.
It was a really long 2 weeks, but a lot of interesting things happened. And so actually that 2 week trip ends up being sort of the narrative glue that holds the narrative arc of the book together, even though the book travels a lot through time, like, you know, through my early childhood and, you know, present time, and it moves around a lot. And we actually go to a lot of places, past and present, but that's sort of the narrative arc. In fact, and even more specifically, there's one specific hike that we go on. In Cachavina, in the middle of the Baja Desert, we go on this hike, and we decide we're going to hike to these rocks, and there are some ancient cave paintings high up on these rocks.
Right.
And so it's about reconnecting with somebody that you've never really been able to know your whole life. But within that reconnecting, I learned even more about myself than I did about my dad and trying to get to know him.
And it comes through actually in the writing itself, in the stories. There's a sense throughout the book of real kind of daughter to father wonderment, or almost like, you know, this sort of almost a bit of a sort of a magic in the way that you view your father and his eccentricity. And again, like I say, wonderment, you know, you get that sense throughout, you know, you're fascinated with your father's work. I mean, you know, just as a child to grow up, I remember one time my uncle took me to a mountain there when I was living in Visalia when I was a kid. He took me up to the mountains and we caught tarantulas, you know, and that was like the most amazing, like that was one of the best memories of my life. And so for a child growing up in this kind of insect world and this other world, having conversations or hearing them about, you know, science and biology and all of that, I mean, it must have been a very fascinating, and that comes through in your language and the way you even sort of the tones and nuances and how you look at how the daughter in the book looks at the father, you know, how you looked at your father. But there is also then that sort of real, the other side of it, which is, you know, the estranged part, the part where you're trying to make sense of your own life and his sort of, you know, and his absence. Even when I think at one point you even say, even when he was there, he was not there. And I'm going to get a little esoteric, because there is something that's really fascinating that you use. There's a sort of one line that you use throughout the book. You had a one in Googleplex chance of being here. Now, for our listeners, you know, this, I think it first appears around, gosh, maybe page 20, like 26 or something like that of your book. There's a Thanksgiving dinner that's happening. And your father references the biologist Stephen Jay Gould's book, Wonderful Life. And,
yes.
And he gives you, or gives us the reader, this brief outline of the theory of bioevolution, which I had to look up. You know, I'll just admit that right up front. I had to look up, Stephen Jay Gould. But, you know, your father says, do you realize that there is a one over a Googleplex chance of you being here, you know? And then he breaks that down. Well, tell us first a little bit about that, you know, what that meant to you. I mean, obviously, I get that throughout the book, but for you in that moment, you know, what did that mean?
Yeah, well, it kind of has, like, in that moment, there's sort of, like, two layers of meaning for me.
Right.
So on one level, there is the literal, in the way that people and animals and life has evolved, one thing is contingent upon another thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you were to go back in time, and I think I even reference in this section, you know, Stephen Jay Gould makes a reference to the movie Back to the Future. Remember that old movie
right.
from the 80s? And in the movie, Doc Brown, he goes to the blackboard and he draws this chart. And on the top line is history as it actually occurred. But then if you make any teeny tiny little change, which in the case of the movie Back to the Future, if Biff Tannen had got that sports almanac the way he had wanted to get it, then history would have veered off in a different direction, and things would not have turned out the way they did in the movie.
Right.
And that's the way real life is, too. You know, there's a billion different possible alternatives, and one little change makes everything come out differently. So on the one level, there's that kind of that academic or intellectual understanding that that's how kind of all of life and creation works.
Yeah.
But then on a personal level, to me, that also means that, okay, so I am who I am now, and I think, I mean, I don't mean to brag on myself, I think I'm a pretty incredible human being.
Yes, you are.
You know,
I
have a wonderful family life and a wonderful career, and I've already checked off a lot of the things on my bucket list, and
nice.
I think I'm a compassionate person.
Yeah.
And so I can look back at, say, how my father was and is and how he raised us. And I could complain all day long. And I spent years doing this, complaining. And you didn't do this and you did that and life is terrible and you were so horrible. But then really, I wouldn't be who I am today were it not for every single aspect that has made up my life until this time, including having who I have for a father. So even though you can look at some of the negative things that have happened, in the end, I think, if I look at the bigger picture, I'm like, you know, some of those things, they needed to happen for a reason. And so there's sort of, for me, there's that two levels of you have the one in Googleplex chance of being here today. On the literal level, you know, in terms of a life form, but also on a personal psychological level as a person functioning today.
That right there is the seed of what actually made me bawl as I was reading the book throughout, because that's the theme that kind of reoccurs throughout the book, you know, is that kind of one in Googleplex chance of being alive. You even break it down further, I think, chapter 23. And I'm just going to read a little tiny chunk of some of this. I'm grateful for that, to be alive. The world is a wonderful place relative to the universe's timeline, though our lifespan is but a blip. And then you say, most of those atoms don't get to be alive at all. Most of those atoms don't get to be a person or fall in love, see sunsets, eat ice cream, and ride bikes, feel the ground shake when the continent shifts. You know, when I was walking to the studio this morning with those words in my mind, on the back of my tongue still, and I just felt so much gratitude for all those things you outline in your book, and it felt like that throughout the entire reading of the book. The only thing I can equate it to is, you know, I have a meditation practice also. And sometimes after having a really good sort of just meditation, I feel that way. Sort of everything is illuminated in the sort of, you know, lucky chance of us being alive, you know. And your book does that wonderfully. And I wondered, you know, not only in the book, I'm going to kind of shift gears a little bit here, but not only in the book, you know, do you turn the mirror onto your father, but it's also your whole family really who you're sort of scrutinizing under the lens, you know. And I'm wondering, as a memoirist, did you ever say to yourself, my God, am I going to really put this in there? Or were there some places that you just didn't want to go, you know?
Yes. I said that to myself so many times.
Am I really doing this?
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, that's something that I thought about a lot. I'm like, oh, you know, do I really want to put this in there? And part of it was like, I thought, well, you know, I'm like one of a million people that's trying to publish their first book, and chances are it's never going to get published and nobody's going to read it anyway, so I might as well just write the heck out of this thing.
That's crazy, I know.
You know?
We have to do those mind games to like be able to get it out, you know?
Yeah. And I think that even though I turn the lens on my family members, and I point out, you know, some complicated issues going on. But I think I also turn the lens on myself, too.
Yeah,
And I think that there's a balance there. Because I'm asking, one of the questions I ask throughout the book is my father a good father or a bad father? Mm-hmm. And how do you determine what good or bad is? But I also am asking myself,
right,
am I a good daughter or a bad daughter? And I even do a little metacognition,
yes,
in here, where I'm saying, I'm writing and exposing my father's weaknesses. Does,
yeah,
that make me a good daughter or a bad daughter?
Yeah.
And I was really worried about how my dad would take the book. And he has read it.
And what did he say? What did he think?
You know, he is really proud. I was really, really nervous.
Sure.
He lives in Mexico now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Mexico just last month,
mm-hmm,
and I went to hand deliver him the very first hardbound copy that I gave away.
Oh, what a moment.
And and he knew that I was writing the book. He had read some things that I had published in the past about our complicated relationship. So, and he knew that the book was coming out, and so, you know, I was really nervous still about giving it to him. I thought, oh, God, I'm going to hurt his feelings. He's never,
sure,
going to speak to me again. And
sure.
I had the book in my purse and when we're there, and he didn't know I actually had it at that moment. And I took him to this really fancy restaurant.
Nice.
And we had several margaritas before dinner, and I finally whip out the book. And he is really proud of me.
Good.
He read the whole book in one day after I gave it to him.
Yeah.
And yeah. I thought, oh God, here it is. He's never going to speak to me again. But he's very proud of me. He's very flattered to have been written about. And he's a very well-read man. So he knows that all of his literature hinges upon conflict and exploration of complicated non-black and white issues.
Mm.
And so he's good with it. And
yeah,
he's good, and he's flattered. And if he has issues with the book, he's being a really good sport, and he has kept those to himself. And
right,
he's only said positive things.
Did he fact check any of your stuff? You know what I mean? Like, I would imagine he'd be like, well, actually, that's a little inaccurate, you know?
I know. He said, wow. He said, you got it right. And he said, you did quite a bit of research for this, didn't you? And I said, yes, I did. And he said, you know, you even got my research correct, because I had to,
wow,
research what my dad researched in order to explain it in just layman's terms that anybody can understand.
Right.
Because my dad, like, none of the information about scorpions or about his,
right,
research on scorpions, I wasn't able to take, he's not my source of information for that, because he is unable to,
yeah,
talk in regular everyday terms that we can all understand. He only speaks in academic speech when it comes to things like that.
Right.
So, yeah, so I passed the muster on the fact checking as well.
Good. There you go.
I felt really good about that.
For sure. And, you know, going back to this, like the language that you use, the biological references and all of that, were you ever afraid that, I mean, because you do a really wonderful job at striking a balance between, you know, giving us this sort of scientific references, you know, and at the same,
mm-hmm,
time, still not making it so obscure that the general reader can't, you know, understand it. I mean, we move along well. It still keeps the story moving along so fluid and so nicely put together, you know. And were you ever worried that some of the biological references would be a little too much or would kind of throw the reader out of the book? I mean, you know, how did you handle that?
Yeah, I was worried about that. And so I wrestled with that quite a bit. And I think what it came down to was, okay, so finding that balance, I thought, well, if if I'm the reader, right, if I'm the reader, I wouldn't necessarily want only just, you know, the scientific informational parts, because it is a memoir. It's the story of my life and my dad's life.
Right.
So I kind of just considered, okay, if I were the reader, if this is the scientific, you know, technical part of it, how would I need it to be followed up with everyday layman's plain speak afterwards?
Right.
So I made a conscious effort to surround the technical stuff with the personal stuff,
right,
so that it connects in a way that everyday readers.
Yeah, and you did a superb job of just that. The book is so multi-layered. And, you know, cyclical in that way, and if that's the right word, you know, it's just it's really a fantastic read all the way through. I enjoyed it. The book is called The Origins of the Universe and What It All Means. We have been speaking with memoirist Carol Firstman about this wonderful, fascinating debut memoir, which in fact was the staff pick by the famous Paris Review. So what an honor that is. And congratulations.
Yeah, what an honor.
Congratulations, Carol. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you so much, Kim. I really, really appreciate this.